But first on the show, Bill Resnick interviews Ali Issa, a field organizer for the War Resisters League and author of Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq. They talk about how the U.S. invasion of Iraq and ongoing war impacted local activists.
Ali Issa, welcome to KABU.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Bill.
Ali Issa is a field organizer for the War Resisters League. It has a local Portland chapter. You can find out what they're doing on the internet. Ali developed a great number of interviews and then wrote and edited the book Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq. Ali, why don't you begin with your background and why you wrote the book?
Sure, Bill. Well, I think one of the big drivers of me putting this together was noticing more and more that people in the mainstream media and even within progressive movements in the U.S. were just very unaware of any independent progressive political organizing happening on the ground in Iraq since 2003. And I got the chance to be an interpreter for an Iraqi labor delegation in New York in 2009, which introduced me to remarkable figures, Falah Alwan, Hassan Jumha, part of the labor movement, that then led me to be in contact with all types of activists and organizers on the ground. And as protest movements surged every couple years since then, I felt like this would be an important thing to document and a way to kind of connect to my roots, since my father is actually from Baghdad.
Uh-huh. My guess is that you really want to challenge the portrait that we get on media of Iraq, of the forces in Iraq and what's happening that so concentrates on the sectarian divisions and battles between the Shiites and Sunnis and misses almost completely the struggle on the ground by women, by environmentalists, by labor, and many other interests. Why don't you comment on that?
Sure. I think what you're saying is very correct, that if you turn on CNN or look back into what the New York Times has said about Iraq, you'll find Kurdish, Shia, Sunni, pretty much as every other word. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Iraqis are kind of simplified that way, because after all, that was how the U.S. written constitution laid out Iraqi political identity. It was also actually something that Saddam played on and played with to kind of divide and rule and strengthen his dictatorship. So the real threat to various internal and outside forces of oppression would be for Iraqis to unify in other ways based on class or a vision of social justice or gender equality, which is exactly what many Iraqis have been doing, to kind of a media blackout that refuses to comprehend those other layers of Iraqi identity. It's not to say that sect doesn't exist, of course, though, and has a long and complex history. But alongside that, just like other communities and histories around the world, people can be religious as well as socially conservative, or want to fight for sovereignty of oil, let's say, in Iraq's case. So I think that deepening of our understanding of Iraqis helps us to try to see actually how much our struggles are similar in Iraq's case and around the world.
Yeah, Iraq is such an interesting country if you look at the history and the possibilities and the potentials and the civic culture in Iraq. It's quite amazing. I'd like for you to talk about the many groups that you were following, talking to people in it, writing about their successes and failures. There's a labor movement. There's struggles for a free press, which did exist for some time in Iraq before Saddam closed everything down. There are gender struggles, women in parliament, struggles against sectarianism. Tell us about all of these struggles for a secular and democratic and really radically democratic Iraq.
Sure, yeah. So I guess starting with the labor movement, people should remember that actually the labor movement in Iraq goes back many, many decades, till the early 30s, actually. There were attempts to organize along certain industries, and that maintained strength until we could say kind of the late 70s. And finally, in 87, Saddam passed a law banning public sector organizing. And that ban was maintained in 2003 with the U.S. occupation. So these unions that I was interviewing were actually working without legal sanction, which meant that they would fight for better working conditions, better pay, the ability to impact economic policy, but were always vulnerable to raids or having their assets seized by the government. And there have been a few different important benchmarks in those struggles, especially in 2007, when an attempt to pass what's called oil and gas law, which would basically have disempowered the Iraqi parliament and allowed the multinational corporations and interests to determine length of contracts, was blocked by an effort led by Iraqi labor unions, especially the oil unions of the South, in a kind of a remarkable defiance of one of the main goals of the U.S. at that time. In addition, actually, much more recently, in August of 2015, part of that ban public sector union organizing was lifted after many, many years of struggling for legal sanction. So at this point, at least in the public sector, there isn't that same constant pressure of having to work underground, which is, yeah, just a testament to how hard they've been working. And actually to the protest movement. So another important link that I was making was between this day-to-day organizing, which is can be very slow and uneventful, to kind of these explosions of participation or anger or deep demands on the government, which happened repeatedly in 2011, 2013, and then 2015. A kind of important figure or family that I document and interviewed repeatedly is the shoe thrower and his brothers. People might recall that Muntadhar Zaidi was a journalist who threw his shoes at George Bush and became kind of a national symbol of defiance. But untold is the story of actually how Odeh Amfarzam and himself at certain points before he kind of went into exile in Lebanon and elsewhere, where it became protest movement leaders. And they were actually using their fame to help mobilize in 2011 when there were kind of mass protests all over Iraq, as well as in later years, asking for various things, improved conditions. Electricity has always been an issue, though Iraq is very wealthy. Many people don't maintain electrical connections. But more fundamentally, I think those protest movements have been, up till this most recent wave that started last summer, to change the sectarian nature of the constitution. As we discussed, the Iraqis have not lived under a sectarian system for most of their history, and I think are recognizing more and more how there's just no way to enact some of these visions for a more just Iraq with the sectarian system that the U.S. and certain Iraqis in the exile that came with them put into place.
The sectarian system, just to clarify, that is reserving seats and reserving power and important jobs like the department heads and the heads of various agencies, reserving them for either Sunnis, Shiites, or Kurds, I guess. And then there's more sectarianism within each of those groups. So they all fight for, everybody's fighting, I suppose, for the spoils under that kind of constitution.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think what's key to mention and what, like, Odeh Zaidi, the shoe thrower's brother, told me repeatedly was just that what's important is that their leaders are accountable to them rather than to kind of an abstract notion of representation, where actually, though political parties have since 2003 generally been dominated by Shia leaders, one of the sects of Islam there that's important in Iraq, it's not like that people that identify as Shia have gotten much out of that, right? Like they're represented by people who are basically unaccountable, except to, let's say, regional or foreign powers. So this identification and protection, supposedly, that kind of someone in your camp or tribe provides has not really led people anywhere and has actually made Iraq so open to influence, not just the U.S., but as well as the Iranian government, the Gulf states, that people are trying to imagine what does independence mean and how would that really change the nature of leadership there up to this past summer and fall and up to the very moment when a popular chant was Bismiddin Bagon and Haramiya, in the name of religion, the thieves have robbed us.
How interesting. This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Ali Issa, who put together a book with a lot of interviews and reports on Iraq. The book is called Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq. We've been talking about the labor movement, which has achieved many victories, along with many other movements.
Yeah, so in addition to general protest movements and labor movement, I documented some very inspiring figures that work with the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, founded in 2003, and has a series of shelters for women that experience many kinds of violence. Much like the labor movement, though, they're actually banned under Iraqi law to operate independently. So these are underground shelters. One of the most remarkable people is named Jannat al-Ghazdi, who, having escaped violence from her own family, ended up in a shelter in Baghdad, and then through their leadership development program and a politicization process, became a very active voice in their radio station and their media projects, so that it was much more than kind of just saving women from militias or patriarchy, but really building leadership, which I think is an inspiration for people working anywhere. And finally, an important sector that is also very little known is some of the environmental activism that's happening. People can imagine that series of wars creates a lot of environmental degradation. And in this case, Turkey is set to build a dam, which is going to impact the Tigris River, a very important river that kind of splits Iraq into two and runs through Baghdad. So I documented how a person named Nadia heard about this campaign on Facebook and became active in it, and kind of her efforts to push the Iraqi government and media to recognize the dangers of this dam. And actually, relatedly, in the south, the marshes were recently recognized as a World Heritage Site based on this work. So that campaign is what allowed for some world recognition, which maybe can have some impact on things like dams.
Tell us a bit about press freedom and struggles for press freedom. I guess that goes on in every country. Is that happening in Iraq?
Well, very much so, yes. Iraq is considered by the Committee to Protect Journalists one of the most dangerous places to work in the media. There have been many, many assassinations of journalists. And going back to the shoe thrower, of course, he was a very successful journalist who was targeted not just because he threw his shoe, but because he was doing investigations into the Iraqi economy and the brick industry's efforts to compete in the Iranian market, actually. So, yeah, press freedom has been a huge struggle, and you'd really have to kind of know your way through Arabic and Kurdish language media to find out what the stories are. But I think social media, as well as a way that I just very directly learned about protests and individuals and contacted people, has shaken things up, where like citizen journalism, as they call it, has played a really crucial role in allowing people to cut through editorial policies and the government. So I think while press freedom might be a long ways away, we do have ways around that. And there's particular Facebook pages that are just invaluable for people to understand what's happening, and for us maybe to possibly translate, for example, so that people in Portland can catch what's going on too.
Iraq has a long history of developed popular secular institutions, and not just institutions, but culture. I remember reading once, it was called the Nation of Poets. Baghdad had a, and still has, I understand, a very vigorous civic culture and public life, and lots of bookstores. A lot of that, of course, was shuttered, and there's been attacks. But my sense is that the practices, the life lived through all of those years, they're still important in Iraqi culture. The education system has been horribly disrupted and destroyed, partly by Saddam and later. But it seems to me still Iraq is both a rich country and a highly developed, literate, and thoughtful society. Does that sound right to you?
It does.
Say a few words on it.
Sure, yeah. I think that's very true. I mean, that's how I was raised, actually. My family was always kind of very big book lovers, and my aunt was named after a famous poet. But I think more immediately, it's true that there's been great stress to Iraqi cultural life and cultural production. But there are weekly gatherings at a famous street called Shahr al-Mutanabbi, Mutanabbi Street, that are extremely active sites of book exchange, conversation, political activism. It's kind of where intellectuals meet. And that place is known. I had a friend who just came back from Baghdad, and I was introducing her to some of the people I know. And she was talking to my friend, saying, okay, let's just meet on Friday on Mutanabbi Street. Like, where else would we go? So though that has been bombed by reactionary elements, and there's various stresses several times since 2003, it keeps going every week. And actually, even outside of Baghdad, which is, of course, kind of the most mixed and diverse place in Iraq, in Najaf as well, in the south, that same friend, Dr. Zahra Ali, discovered a bookstore called Moja, which was attempting to kind of create or build on the legacy that you were describing before of free thinking and inquiry and kind of getting young people reading and talking in a kind of very religiously conservative city like Najaf. So that's very much true, and that despite these great stresses, the Iraqi will to read and think and dream thrives.
One final thing. Those forces and the popular movements in Iraq, they really need support, and they're looking for support from around the world. How would they be supported? You're part of that support network, a very important part. What do you see as the possibilities of building that kind of support, and how would that be done?
Yeah, that's an important question. I think because in Iraq's case, often just convincing people that these individuals and movements exist is a struggle. We're kind of at the beginning stages of what we might imagine as solidarity work. But there are existing channels, such as something that people could look up called the Iraqi Civil Society Solidarity Initiative, which is connected to the Save the Tigris and Marshes campaign, connected to some of the unions, and the women's groups. But there's also actually an outgrowth of the book has been a formation of a collective of Iraqis in the diaspora, like myself. And we formed just for that reason, actually, to imagine how to build solidarity with people on the ground, to connect with each other. And we're now in kind of a dozen cities around the world, calling ourselves the Iraqi Transnational Collective. So I'd say people looking that up on Facebook and just contacting me, I'd love to talk to anybody that's interested in imagining what we could do. Like I was saying, I think Iraqis have great needs for visibility and solidarity, but at the same time, they actually have much to offer, because if they're organizing in those conditions, it seems that organizing is possible anywhere.
Thanks so much for talking to us. Why don't you repeat the websites and the groups that people could get information about?
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill. People can contact me at ali@warresisters.org. They can find the book at tedweenpublishing.com. And they can follow the Diaspora Network on Facebook by searching Iraqi Transnational Collective.
Iraqi Transnational Collective. And, of course, the book is, again, Against All Odds, Voices of Popular Struggle in Iraq. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Ali. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Bill.